This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Bloomington Police Chief Clay Wheeler says the policy on contacting immigration authorities is much like the one in the town of Normal.
For anything that doesn't need an immediate decision right that then, it's something that goes through my office.
Wheeler talks with Eric Stock months after a welcoming city ordinance failed at the city council level. Plus, Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director Ken Lamb talks about the cold nights and warm music of Scandinavia, previewing a concert of music of Grieg, Nielsen, and Sibelius. And GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has a trivia conversation, not a trivial one, though, with the Friends of the Arts. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. After nearly 2 years of heated debate over Bloomington's stance on contact with federal immigration agents, the police department has quietly adopted roughly the same policy used by the town of Normal. Immigration activists had feared Immigration and Customs Enforcement would be getting police help rounding up undocumented immigrants. In this interview with GLT's Eric Stock, Police Chief Clay Wheeler says the new policy means contact with ICE will rarely be an issue, and then only in criminal matters.
It was something that the mayor put out his recommendation to us of having a policy that for something that did not pass council and did not have the full support of council. Basically what we have done is it's the practice within the department of how to address that, and we follow the Trust Act and the information provided by the Illinois Attorney General's office and how to we should address the issues brought through in the Trust Act.
So can you say under what circumstance your officers will interact with immigration agents?
In my 28-year history, it's very, very seldom. And definitely on a routine basis for a police officer on the street, it's probably something that doesn't even happen during their career. It's hard. It's a very general question to ask. For the most part, it's something that doesn't really occur at all. If there were to be something that immigration would ask for, if they were to go look for violent offenders and ask for our help or something, it'd have to be something that we at a command level would make a decision on based upon the needs of the community. No different, really, than the policy in effect over at Normal as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. They had adopted a policy shortly before this was handled here in Bloomington. So was there an effort to have parity between the two departments to avoid any confusion from the public standpoint?
Yes, and that's basically what we're doing. Is Normal has a policy of if an immigration issue comes up, if an ICE agent, so to speak, comes and asks for assistance, that has to be gone through supervisors, the chief's designee, which at Normal is the lieutenants, and here as well. And we've given that direction to our command staff as well. And really, for anything that doesn't need an immediate decision right that then, as far as something that's occurring on the street, it's something that goes through my office and gets documented.
For something that seems to come up so rarely, according to what you've described as your interactions over all your time here, did everybody make too big a deal about this? This was an ongoing issue for a year or more.
It's the eye of the beholder. If you're somebody that has those concerns, because that's the part of the community that you live in or you are part of, I can understand how it was a concern, because there was the paranoia or thought that there was much more going on, and during different parts of the country there was. It necessarily didn't translate to here. So it's a very important issue to some people. We understand that. And that's, I think, why Illinois came out with the Trust Act and reminded police officers that most of immigration is a civil matter, not a criminal matter for the law enforcement officers to deal with. So that's the direction the guy on the street has, is it's a criminal thing, or it's not a criminal thing, it's a civil item that's not their purview, not for them.
The city's Public Safety and Community Relations Board formed a year ago to help the city address concerns about alleged mistreatment by officers and specifically how the department handles those complaints. Now, the department went the first year without any complaints that went to the PSCRB. The first one was filed just a few weeks ago, and by that we are referencing the department's handling of the complaints, not the initial complaints themselves. Do you feel creating this commission has changed the public's view of officers, and has it changed how officers interact with the public in any way?
I suppose it would for some of the citizens. I haven't really talked to anybody that's told me that, so I don't know firsthand. I have heard some people say that maybe the fact that there's a board and somebody looking at nature of complaints has changed the way the officers have done their job. Me as the leader of this organization, I support anything where our officers say, you know what, I need to do the right thing and do things the right way. So if they feel that a little bit and have changed anything, I don't see that they've changed anything. But if that's a possibility, it certainly doesn't hurt that somebody believes that doing the right thing is a good idea. I think my staff, they do the right thing because that's why they hired on here, and that's what we tell them to do, is to try to do the right thing by people because that's what they believe in and why they're police officers.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Bloomington Police Chief Clay Wheeler. 2018 was the deadliest year in Bloomington Normal in about three decades for gun violence. Man, there were several dozen incidents of armed violence as well. Often violence begets more violence because of the need for retaliation and for rivals to feel the need to police themselves. How much of this do you believe is part of a trend, or was 2018 an outlier year?
We're certainly hoping it's an outlier. When you look at the overall statistics in regards to how many shootings there have been, the rate of homicides is an outlier because the rate of shootings has actually decreased or almost stayed stable. So that makes us hopeful that it is an outlier. Certainly it's something you don't want to just take for granted, though. Kind of the role that we take here at the Bloomington Police Department, though, is a serious crime like this, we go all hands on deck. And we put every resource that we have at our disposal in trying to solve those crimes, to help the victims and the families of the victims, and also just the accountability for who's responsible for it, and the message to the community that if you're going to do those type of things here, you're going to be held accountable.
Can you say whether there are similarities that police have noticed in these shootings that point to any trends in terms of, say, source of weapons, the people involved, or circumstances that may have led to the violence, or do you see them all as isolated?
I think that's something we're going to want to talk more about after some of the cases go through trial, because I certainly don't want to say anything that's going to jeopardize a trial. Definitely one thing that we're going to have to look at. I mean, there's a lot of scaling back, trying to make sure that we're reducing the numbers in prisons, especially for nonviolent crimes. But we have to be careful that by reducing the numbers of people in prisons doesn't go into some of the violent acts and put violent criminals back on the streets. So that's one thing that we've got to be careful about, and we're going to have conversations about going forward.
Is there an idea how much of this violence could possibly be attributed to hybrid gangs? Do you know which ones might be most responsible, and what are the challenges to dealing with these alliances that are sort of more decentralized now?
I don't think that's really something I can strongly comment about yet. Sometimes when people see crimes, and situations develop between different hybrid gangs and different gangs. Sometimes, in my opinion, it's attributed too much to the name of the gangs involved or something, where it's people involved with those different groups of people, but still the core instance that caused the violence is something just occurring between people. Like it could be, say, a fight amongst people about a girl. It can still come down to that basic type of thing that doesn't necessarily have as much to do with that. So it's a more complicated question than necessarily there is an easy answer.
Now, in 2017 or 2018, the community had reacted to the opioid crisis with a full-throated response. There was a McLean County Opioid Initiative, the Safe Passage Program. There were several panel discussions, including law enforcement, prosecutors, the coroner. It seems that the spike in gun violence hasn't quite sparked the same response. There were a few vigils, and that was largely it. What do you make of that contrast?
I don't agree with that summation. Police departments looked towards community partners. There were several events where community partners, social service agencies, all looked at what services they have available. There was quite discussions publicly and behind scenes about the issue. So I wouldn't say that that's fairly characterized at all.
What role do community-sponsored programs for youth play in helping to combat the problem, do you feel?
Well, the more the better. Anything to keep young kids focused and understanding that they have a future. I think where we run into problems is when we have kids believing that they don't have a future, that they don't have to worry about what happens because they don't feel anything's good's going to ever come for them. So why make good decisions towards your future if all you're worried about is the now? So that's where those type of agencies and programs help.
Is that hard to get kids to participate in that, to see the big picture?
Yes, absolutely.
As we continue with Bloomington Police Chief Clay Wheeler, shifting back to drugs, if I may, McLean County had a sizable drop in overdose deaths last year after there was a record high number in 2017. Have you seen a difference at all in the drug trade on the streets in the last year?
I don't know that. I don't believe so. I think there's also probably been a record amount of Narcan saves, so that might have something to do with some of the reductions in deaths.
Is it education more that's helping, that we're more aware of the dangers that has led to this drop, or is it too early to say?
Probably a combination of all those things. Definitely maybe some enforcement has helped in some areas. Education has probably helped in some areas. Like I said, like Narcan having positive effects for reducing some of the deaths. All that's a combination.
And from what we gathered from the coroner, the spike at the time was largely attributed to fentanyl being mixed with heroin and causing reactions that were so powerful they led to overdose reactions for first-time users. Could it be now that the suppliers are making adjustments based on that knowledge, so they basically are not killing off the customer base like they have been?
It could be. That could be part of it as well.
As we continue with Bloomington Police Chief Clay Wheeler, as we shift to another drug that's been sort of marginally decriminalized in the last couple of years, could become legal soon. The new governor, J.B. Pritzker, has advocated for allowing marijuana for recreational use, and it appears he has the support of the state legislature, could make that happen this year. Some supporters have said that this would give police more time to focus on more serious crimes. Would you be better able to go after harder drugs under the circumstance, or could this lead to an increase in harder drug use?
That argument doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because marijuana is not something that we spend a great deal of time on anyway. I mean, we already had that focus of going towards opioids or cocaine because of crack epidemic that was so prevalent for years. Yeah, do we spend some time on some cases occasionally? Yes, for good reason, though, because a lot of our cannabis cases arise out of a great deal of violence. Because of the money behind that trade, a lot of times it has outpaced some of the other drug trade for the amount of violence that comes with it.
When we spoke with the state's attorney about this a short time ago, Don Knapp, he said he was concerned that since marijuana became a citation a couple of years ago rather than being a criminal offense, that there have likely been fewer traffic stops. Sometimes those traffic stops produce guns and other weapons, so there may be fewer of those now. Is that a concern, that sort of the rules of engagement are maybe a little different now, that simply smelling marijuana may not be enough?
Well, there will be some of those things may change. Right now it does offer probable cause for an officer to search a vehicle if he smells burnt cannabis in the vehicle. Sometimes that does lead to other things, like maybe identifying somebody in the car that's warrant for a violent warrant, or a gun in the car, or other kinds of drugs as well, cannabis and so forth. So that will change some things, but we'll adapt and we'll keep doing what we do. And we'll get there.
And are you concerned about the potential for more DUIs from, say, empty nesters and others who maybe have never tried marijuana, but they might be inclined to try it now and get on the road, perhaps not aware of the effects, or their body isn't prepared for the effects?
I'm not sure about the empty nest aspect of it, but I am concerned about the DUIs, because there's not currently as effective field sobriety, and even more importantly, the testing to find out exactly what level and everything involved is, to be able to do that in a timely fashion, and better for you to identify as well, to be able to get impaired drivers off the roadway. If you look at the places where the legalization has occurred, their fatal accidents and their impaired driving accidents have skyrocketed.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Bloomington Police Chief Clay Wheeler. There have been a lot of recent changes in the police department with the administration, some retirements, of course, you coming on board as chief, and there's been your usual turnover. Where are you in terms of staffing levels on the street and having the experience that you need on the street?
We're about four officers down right now. We have several in training, so the reality of the boots on the ground, so to speak, of the officers on the street is a little heavier than four down. Part of that came from hiring freezes that we went through during budgetary times and so forth, trying to recover from that. So staffing levels are, I would say the thing about our staffing levels is we've, at the Bloomington Police Department, through all these years of budgetary issues that I'm sure you followed and covered, we have tried to help with that budgetary problem as much as we can by trying to make sure that we're allocating enough officers on the street to be able to properly enforce the laws and safeguard our public. We don't have any extra, and that's gonna start catching up with us as the city grows, as the demands on the officers grows. We're going to be feeling the need for some more officers, and really the necessity for us to have enough to do anything extra. As we talk about trying to go in the community and do community engagement and that type of thing, it gets harder and harder to do that when you only have enough officers for answering calls for service.
Is it too much to ask, with everything that they already have on their plate, handling the law enforcement aspect of it to, as you said, be sort of a social worker as well?
It's a lot to ask. It's what's been asked of us for centuries. It's never going to stop. My point, though, is as funding has eroded from the social service, from the mental health services, more and more then is put upon us. More and more is asked upon us. More and more of our time is spent on those type of issues. And I definitely think that it's important that we properly fund those as well.
Bloomington Police Chief Clay Wheeler spoke with GLT's Eric Stock. Wheeler adds the department doesn't have any new details about the city's only fatal shooting from last year that remains unsolved. Trevante Kirkwood, who was gunned down in the 1300 block of North Oak Street last November. Police say at the time they did not believe the shooting was a random act.
Support for GLT comes from Bloomington Library, where books are just the beginning. The library will introduce kids age 8 to 11 to the world of fiber art on January 29th. They'll explore needlework, rug making, weaving, macrame, and more beginning at 4 o'clock in the story room. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a look at the connection between life expectancy and opioid use in Illinois. Some residents of Mercer County in western Illinois are worried about the possible impact of a proposed new hog-raising operation. They've organized. They're trying to stop it. IPR's Herb Trix reports on the effort and the loopholes the hog farmer is using to limit public exposure.
The site is 25 acres, about 2 miles south of Viola, and it would be used to raise more than 2,000 hogs. Mike Hollenbach, a member of the Concerned Neighbors and Farmers of Mercer County, says it's surrounded by 23 homes and farms, and it's just the latest of these large animal confinements to be built in his county.
Some of these are in spaces that are not bothering anybody, so to say. It just so happens that this one is right in the middle of at least 23 families. There's no way it's not going to affect all of us.
He and the other neighbors are also upset that they have so little say in what happens. That's because the proposal is for up to 2,499 hogs.
If they had one more hog, the 2,500, they would have a larger setback that they'd have to go by. They would have to have a public meeting to tell everyone what they plan to do with the waste. It had to be a public informational meeting. With the one hog less, they don't have to tell anybody anything. We have no idea what they're going to do with the waste management. No idea what they're going to do for pollution control, odors, everything else like that.
Illinois law requires a setback or a distance of at least 1/4 mile between a livestock operation like this and occupied homes, and at least 1/2 mile to the nearest populated area. That could be a town or a church or a school. According to Doug Owens from the Illinois Department of Agriculture, he's the bureau chief for environmental programs. Owens says the setback rules took effect in 1996, and his department is responsible for all aspects of setting up these animal confinements, the site, construction plans, and final approval before it opens.
Our requirements for liquid waste are at least 150 days of manure storage for whatever animal unit capacity the applicant would be proposing. And typically what the facility would do would be to apply that waste or that manure to farmland as a nutrient to that farmland. There are setbacks from wells, residences, surface water.
But once it opens, he says, the Illinois Agriculture Department is done, and any complaints about manure, odors, and groundwater go to the Illinois EPA. Nick Anderson from the Illinois Livestock Development Group says at this proposed confinement near Viola, young hogs would be brought in at about 15 pounds and 3 weeks old and stay up to 5 months until they're around 280 pounds. The barn would then be emptied and cleaned and prepared for the next group to be finished. He thinks a 1/4 mile setback is sufficient.
Whether 1/4 mile and 1/2 mile are correct, it does put a standard out there. And I will tell you from my experience, and I can go right into Mercer County and look at it, and we can step off those 1/4 mile sections at where a hog farm might be. Not that it eliminates any impact or odor, but it dissipates it enough that it's not an everyday thing and it doesn't ruin people's lives and we go on about our lives quite normally.
Anderson says Illinois' 1/4 mile setback rule is much stricter than neighboring states, more than double Iowa's and 3 times greater than Indiana's. He also points to the economic impact for Mercer County.
The pork industry in Mercer County, if you just kind of think about it, it generates, you know, it's going to consume almost 3 million bushels of corn every year and almost a million bushels of soybeans. You know, I think there's almost 200, 250 jobs responsible for the pork industry in Mercer County alone.
But Mike Hollenbach from the Concerned Neighbors Group is still worried and still opposed. So he and the neighbors are protesting, writing letters, putting up signs, and seeking legal help.
We are, you know, a coalition of neighbors and family farmers out here that just do not want this in the middle of our homes.
Anderson says the proposal comes from a young man who works for Biddle Farms, which is based in Joy. That's opened at least several of these hog operations in the county in recent years. I'm Herb Trix.
Herb Trix is part of an IPR station in the Quad Cities. He reports on Mercer County there. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
You know, mornings can define the rest of your entire day. Find $5 you forgot about in your pocket, it's going to be a good day. Spill your coffee all over yourself, probably going to be a bad one. But when you begin your day with Morning Edition, you start fully awake with the latest and most important news to prepare you for whatever comes next. Take control of your day. Listen to Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University, designated a military-friendly school by Victory Media and ranked among the country's best universities for veterans by College Factual and Military Advanced Education and Transition. More at illinoisstate.edu/pointsofpride. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, cold nights and warm Scandinavian music. The Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director joins us. For 2 years in a row, the average U.S. life expectancy has declined. The director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention attributes that situation mainly to a rise in suicides and opioid overdoses. Though life expectancy has remained steady in Illinois, suicide and opioid-related deaths have climbed steeply. For this week's Illinois Issues, Maureen McKinney looks into what connection might exist.
When Maria Louisa Tucker's father died after swallowing a sizable amount of a prescribed opioid, hydrocodone, she saw it as a personal tragedy for her family. But after investigating the opioid crisis and the connection to mental health issues, the journalist said she took a broader view of her dad's 2006 suicide.
And that's sort of when a light bulb went on for me. And I realized, like, oh, well, you know, maybe the hydrocodone played a bigger part in my father's death than I had thought. And maybe this wasn't just a personal tragedy for me. Maybe this was something that had been repeating itself.
Tucker's not alone in thinking there could be a clearer link than what's been widely reported in the medical community. Jill Harkavy-Friedman is vice president for research at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
I think we're all wondering about the connection between suicide deaths and opioid deaths. And it's likely that there are some connections for some of the deaths, and then for other deaths, not as much of a connection. The issue is that many times people who are suicidal might be using substances like opioids, and vice versa. So there can be a lot of overlap. And it can be very hard to tell when somebody died, was it an accident? Or did they purposely die by suicide?
Harkavy Friedman's organization is funding a year-long study beginning this month that will look for connections. The researchers will take information from about 100 relatives of those who died by their own hand, as well as people who lost loved ones to opioid use and other drug-related causes. That will be compared against information gleaned from those who have experienced loss because of traumatic causes such as aggressive cancer or heart failure. The importance of the research is to help survivors as they struggle to make sense of a seemingly senseless death. The researcher wrote that as suicide rates and opioid deaths climb, it is imperative to identify the most effective forms of support for those survivors. Suicides in Illinois are up 26% this decade. Meanwhile, opioid deaths have skyrocketed to more than 22,000, a number more than doubled over a four-year period. Nationally, opioid-related deaths are the highest they've ever been, and the number of suicides hasn't been larger in the 50 years the data has been tracked by the federal government. Joseph Triani, a licensed clinical drug counselor and psychology professor at Adler University in Chicago, calls this combination of suicides and opioid overdoses, along with the rise in self-inflicted gun deaths, a perfect storm.
In addiction, you lose everything. You lose your family. You lose your dignity. You lose your job. One has to resort to things that they might never have dreamed of doing as a result of their addiction. And as one addict said to me, who survived a suicide, he said, "Doc, you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And, you know, this looks like the best option out. You know, I've got to end it for myself. I've got to end it for everyone that I've hurt. I don't want to go on hurting people as a result of my addiction."
Triani says some of the keys to tackling the issue are education of the public and the medical community, and maybe most importantly, an increase in services.
When somebody is ready for help or wanting help, desperation occurs when that help is not available. And if it's not available, the option of suicide becomes very real as a way out.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. GLT News is bringing you another round of candidate forums, and you can participate by submitting a question right now at WGLT.org. Get to know the incumbents and the challengers in the upcoming municipal elections. On Thursday, March 7th, you'll hear from candidates running for Town of Normal Council. On March 19th, it's a forum for Bloomington Council candidates. Learn more about the two events and submit questions at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. With frigid temperatures and winter upon us, you might feel as if a concert of music from chilly Scandinavia would not be a great thing. But Illinois Symphony Orchestra music director Ken Lamb says not so, with the music on the program tonight in Bloomington at the Center for the Performing Arts. Lamb says Nielsen, Grieg, and Sibelius drew from the warm center of their country's folk traditions. They are sonically different in their approach to music, but Lamb says they come from a time of nationalist awakenings among composers getting over the high classical period.
All of these composers used music from their countries, so there's a folk element. If you listen to, for instance, the beginning of the Nielsen Concerto, you immediately are struck by this sort of very simple folk-like melody. Sibelius, the symphony, the second movement is basically a folk song. Grieg, of course, you know, he's the master of using Norwegian melody and sources. All three composers were very important in their respective countries because they, just like the Czechs, like Dvořák and Smetana and Bartók, you know, they were really trying to find the sounds from their own country, because music, if you look at the classical times or even early Romantic, it really belongs to the German and Italians. And so when came the middle of the 19th century, a lot of countries are beginning to think, okay, well, what do we have? What do we have to offer? We don't just go to Germany and study, but we want to incorporate some of our own national elements into it. So I think these three composers are representative of music in those countries.
Your perspective is an international one. So from an internationalist looking inward to Scandinavian composers, what do they mean to you? What sonically do you take from them that you think, aha, so cool, or that makes it Scandinavian to me?
It's interesting. I've never actually been to Scandinavia. There is always people think, well, you'd really need to live in that country to get a real sense of what the music is about. Now, I don't disagree, but I think the notes tell you a lot, too. I think when you meet Scandinavians, you also get a sense of their sensibilities. So, for instance, Nielsen's Clarinet Concerto, Nielsen's music, it's It's not sentimental music. Trait in the Danes, it is sort of the edges are a little hard, and also the use of particular intervals in the music actually mirrors the language. In Danish, they speak in a lot of minor thirds, falling minor thirds apparently. So you find this all over the place in the Nielsen Clarinet Concerto. So I think the language, the culture, and the sensibilities of the people influences. So as an interpreter from outside, I think you start from the notes. The notes are universal. And the notes are going to mean something different to me than you, and it's different to a native Finn or a Norwegian. And I think that's the beauty of classical music.
Let's talk a little bit more about the clarinet concerto. It's not like the Peer Gynt Suite, which is a classic and even a chestnut for some people. And it's not, doesn't have the grandeur of Sibelius's Finnish approach to nature and Scandinavia. Tell us a little bit more about what's going on in Nielsen's head as he lays this out.
Well, the history of the concerto is well documented. I mean, he planned to write five wind concertos for members of the Danish wind quintet, and he only managed to write the flute and the clarinet concertos before he passed away. He wanted each concerto to mirror the personalities of those wind players that he was writing for. You read the correspondence between the soloists and the composers and other commentators, and you get a sense of the kind of humor Nielsen had. And it's sort of dry, the humor's dry. Exploring the many moods of the clarinet. The clarinet can be a very gentle, soothing instrument, or the clarinet can scream. I think at one point it was described as screaming like a tram, squeaking on tracks that are not very well oiled. So there are plenty of these moments, so you know, alternating from very melodic, very tonal. And in fact, Nielsen is one of those who never really abandoned tonality, and it made tonality really a central feature of his works, and in this concerto no less. But there are moments that it's very forward-looking and modernistic. So of course, it's scored for a chamber-sized orchestra with strings and two horns and two bassoons, but with the addition of this little snare drum. Front page of the score. He doesn't want a big side drum. He wants this little, like a small and bright, like a toy snare drum. And it's sort of more, the effect is not militaristic. It's sort of, it's like a like your best friend egging you on to do things.
You know, think Leopold Mozart's Toy Symphony. You know, it's a very crisp and upbeat and fun kind of thing.
Yes. So, and it's very difficult. It's, you know, if you speak to string players, it's probably one of the hardest things they will ever play. Because a lot of the times when we do a program, you know, you focus on the symphony. You look at Sibelius V and all these passages, and then come the concerto. Oh my goodness, it's going to be a really fun challenge.
Tell us about Sibelius V. It's a big work. Sibelius himself had grand themes. There's a lot to cover, but let's pick one thing.
Of course, everybody loves the last movement, the swan song, when the horns just sing this great theme that was inspired by, you know, apparently a flock of swans flying. But the moment, really, for me, that made this symphony irresistible is that little transition in the first movement from the... I think a lot of people will know that there are a number of different versions of the symphony. The very first version has four different movements. And Sibelius took the Beethoven 9 model, which is you have a first movement, then you have the scherzo, then a slow movement and a finale. And in Beethoven 5th symphony, it was one of the first time that Beethoven merged two movements together, from the scherzo to the finale. And Sibelius ended up merging the first and second movements, sewed them together. And if we don't know the original version, we think that transition, it's the most natural thing on earth. And you would not have thought that he conceived it as two separate movements before. And I think that transition in the first movement is probably one of the most miraculous things in all of classical music. Point this out to the audience before they listen to it, because I always think about it, if you're doing a jigsaw puzzle, and this is essentially Sibelius's process for this symphony, is that you started with, you know, all those 1,000 pieces and you have no idea what it is, and you started to put things in, and you know that moment that you've at first is really hard, you know, because you don't know anything, and then you see a partial picture. And that's the moment when it becomes clear what you're actually trying to piece together. And then it becomes easier. And that's kind of the first movement. And at the end, he reveals what you've been trying to piece together all this time. And it's just one of the... It gives me chills even to just think about it.
Listen live to the Illinois Symphony Orchestra at 7:30 p.m. at the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. You heard Sabina Meyer performing the Nielsen Clarinet Concerto with the Berlin Philharmonic under Sir Simon Rattle, and Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic for the excerpts of Grieg's Symphony No. 5. Ken Lamb is the music director of the Illinois Symphony. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Trivia doesn't mean trivial. to the ISU Friends of the Arts, who are holding a fundraiser that turns fun facts into a chance to help rising artists. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The Friends of the Arts Trivia Night is coming up Saturday, February 9th at 5:30 p.m. in CVA 110 on the Illinois State University campus. The event is a fundraiser for the College of Fine Arts Student Scholarships and Project Grants. This is the second year for the Trivia Night fundraiser. Board member Jerry Antonini says the theme is A Night at the Movies. So if you know your Marvel movies, Disney flicks, and Bogart from Bacall, this is the Trivia Night for you. Board member Jody DeKramer says they have categories for all film fans.
This is going to be 8 rounds. So we have 7 categories, movie locations. So all the answers will be a location that the movie was either made at or supposed to be in. Hollywood celebrities, dead or alive. Now, this will be an interesting one. This comes from my friends always sitting around, and we mention somebody, and it's like, is that person dead or alive? And the answer will just be
dead or alive. So what else?
Horror and sci-fi film, Marvel comics and superhero films, sports films, Hollywood scandals and romances, and romance and Disney films.
If I want to come to the trivia night, can I participate as an individual, or do I have to put together a team?
Either one. If you want to just come as an individual, you can, and we'll assign you to a team. Otherwise, if you have a team in mind, you can get everyone together and come as a team. We do try to have at least 6 people, 6 to 8 per team.
All right. Can you give me some examples, you guys, of some of the questions we might encounter?
Are you going to answer these, Laura?
I'll try.
Do you think you're a Hollywood expert? We're going to see.
Hollywood is what I'm good at.
So from our category, Dead or Alive.
All right.
Hal Holbrook, Dead or Alive.
Ooh, that's a good one. I think he's alive.
He is alive. Very good. In fact, he's 93 years old.
Bless him.
I know.
Way to go.
That's one of those ones you're like, well, wait a minute. Did I hear he was dead?
You know, because for a long time, I thought he was dead.
See, and that's what people think. Wait, is he dead? When's the last time you saw them?
And then they booked him in the BCPA for something, and I went, oh, he's alive.
That's right.
Okay,
I think
good.
I saw that
That's good to see.
Okay, from movie locations, the 1979 film Breaking Away is about teenagers living in this city.
Bloomington, Indiana.
Wow.
You are good.
Not to be confused with Bloomington, Illinois.
Right. Okay, here's one from romance and Disney films. Released in 1937, this was Disney Studios' first full animated movie.
Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
She's on my team.
Sign her up.
We're going to sign her up.
These are good questions. See, and this is the thing about Trivia Nights is you need to make sure it's hard enough to be challenging, but not so hard that it's not fun for folks.
So we do have a nice balance of questions. Some will be like, oh, gosh, everybody knows this. But there will be some that people will have to really reach back and go, oh.
And these go back to Hollywood history, and
contemporary
films, too.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so our last one is from sports films.
Oh, boy.
Name the movie where Gene Hackman plays the coach who leads this small-town high school basketball team to the state championship.
Hoosiers.
There you go.
Again.
Okay, so these were like the easier ones.
Yes, well, I'm glad. So that gives us a good example of what we can expect at Friends of the Arts Trivia Night. So as I said, you're raising funds for scholarships and project grants. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
We have what's called a Friends of the Arts Scholarship, and that is available to students who are new to campus, so either as a freshman or a transfer student in their junior year, and it's a 2-year scholarship. And they apply for it, and then we have a limited number that we can give every year. And so it's good for 2 years. And then grant projects, the students would then fill an application explaining their project and what they're wanting funds for. And we have a committee that reviews that and then grants money to them.
And that can be individual or group.
Now, the questions you asked me were pretty good. I got them right, so they had to have been pretty easy. But could you purchase hints or answers at this event?
Sure can. Either a hint or an answer.
So you really know how to raise funds.
Right. And that's what we're there for.
So the hints, which are just a hint, are $3, and then you can purchase the whole answer for $10 if you really want to get ahead in the points.
One thing, we did have an event in early December called a Messiah Sing-Along, in which people who wanted to sing songs from Messiah could come. If you still have your program from that event and you bring it, it's worth a free hint for an answer or for one of the questions.
Oh, that's good. Now, did you tell them at the time to hold on to their programs?
It was actually printed in the program.
Oh, good. So really testing people to make sure they read the program.
That's right.
What are you guys hoping to raise with this event? How much?
We'll take any amount we can get. obviously anything would help our project and scholarship grants. We'd like to raise at least $1,000.
So you've got a Hollywood theme going on with this trivia night. Are you encouraging people to dress up like it's a Hollywood opening?
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's optional.
What about coming dressed as your favorite Hollywood actor or actress?
Fantastic.
Yes, we really haven't, but we should maybe give a prize for the best
dress. That'd be a good idea.
Movie tickets would be good.
Would you like to join our committee next year?
What's the price for attending the event?
It's $15 per person, or if you have a group and you want to reserve a table for yourselves, it's $100 for a table. And so up to eight people, the $100 actually is cheaper than eight individual tickets at 15. So 15 per person or 100 per group of eight.
We do have a student price this year of $10.
You know, sometimes answering trivia questions makes me hungry and thirsty. Will you have food and drink available?
We sure do. We will have dinner, which should basically be like sandwiches, chips, and cookies for purchase, as well as soda, water, and a cash bar.
And they usually come up with some sort of specialty drink for us. So
a special sort of Hollywood-themed cocktail.
Right, like, you know, a dirty Shirley Temple or something like that.
That's Jody DeCramer and Jerry Antonini from Friends of the Arts. Their trivia night is coming up Saturday, February 9th at 5:30 p.m. in CVA 110 on the ISU campus. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and from Laura Kennedy. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.